Watson will be correcting this evening, if he wants to donate. Meanwhile, we welcome two speakers. Fabio Ricard and Nicky Best will be talking about Bayesian and structural integration of background evidence in the Zanna's interpretation of clinical trial data. And already in that title there are so many potential questions coming up. But I think this discussion group will love to discuss them once we've had some little glimpse of what the speakers would like to tell us. So thank you, and away you go.
That's lovely, thank you. I've got about 10 slides, so we have 10 ones. So we'll try to get through them as slowly as possible. Please, if you have any questions, I might be instructed.
So if you can speak a little louder, please.
Right, okay. So here's what I'm going to be talking about. It's the rationale for this data generation. It's you know, everything is inspired by a small early study of the kind that you're certainly seen many times. The particular question that I will be entertaining will be about the association of some baseline variables to clinical responses, the therapeutic area near as a quality service, precise criteria to define response. We'll just be talking about sort of binary response and not change. And then the main message here is that this kind of study is underpowered. What to do about it, not so much about the why, but what to do about it if you're about to extract information from the study. Summary way forward, the way forward would lead me to Nicky's talk. One of the ways forward is thereby integration across trials of data, and we certainly have many ways of doing that, and we'll see that in the second part of this talk. So as a statistician, trying to do my best in oncology is always fascinating to go back all the way to the 2000s when the ballpark of cancer series of papers started to appear, which is a bit of a summary of much, of course, not all of the research that had been further developed the idea about, you know, what this path works, what is cancer, what are the fundamental biological processes from which what we call cancer originates, the processes through which it develops. And this is the first image of the 2000 paper that identifies six macro processes, and by now in 2018 you will have heard these things over and over again. So the resistance to apoptosis, the uncontrolled growth, the vascularization, many of the type of processes which have then been, they have been used to develop therapies, and some of them quite effective, but we're not quite there yet. So epigenetic dysregulation is then it's one of these mechanisms leading to this complex operation in cell physiology, which can take even decades to and in particular the transcription of DNA to RNA, or proteins that should not be transcribed, is one form of such dysregulation, which then puts into the cytoplasm a bunch of proteins that should not be there. Therefore, we need a different
So, case study, RNA was extracted from actually bone marrow aspirates of an athlete subject. This thing can happen basically in two ways. The samples are either voluntary, so it's an opportunistic study. This one is an opportunistic study. The patients were not requested to commit to this kind of sampling to participate in the study. Nevertheless, 34 of them provided that sample, which is not the end to be able to send you for a bunch. Then, what do? We use RNA-seq to quantify from those samples of the bone marrow the relative abundance, or the abundance, the expression of a plague of transcripts. Well, transcripts, they're bits of genes, very roughly speaking. So one RNA transcript is not one gene. You do not expect about 30,000 of them, 60,000. It works by shotgun sequencing, and there's an incredible complexity behind the derivation of the raw data that we're going to be using for analysis. And this is the realm of computational biology, and you can clearly see that to the interaction of the food chain that happens between them and us. So then you've got these 32 people that agreed to having these samples. Again, they're relatively, it's not that expensive, but definitely a laborious technique to extract the expression of each transcript. What do you want to get out of that? Many things, among which the question that again we are focusing on tonight is a very long shot type of question. So what is the association, if any, between the baseline RNA-seq expression data and the clinical responses? Yeah. Open parenthesis, in this particular context of this case study, this made some sense among various reasons, among which the responses they're going to see were elicited at various doses. For example, the obvious question here would be, how about those? Obviously, homogeneous at least from the point of view of exposure. No, they were not, but the distribution of responses was. So that's, if you want to, one relatively lame, but nevertheless, one reason to commit such a long shot type of question. Baseline expression, as if it was, as if exposure was constant, you know, do we see an association in response? If that association was there, it would at least form a hypothesis to mediate further thinking on patient selection. Not so much from a positive predictive point of view, but most immediately from a negative predictive point of view. Is there a signature associated to any possibility, at least to the response? If there is, for the obvious reasons, so the question is quite correct that you see here. Can a larger of n designs provide strong evidence? Probably not, but we gave it our best shot here. And we learned a lot in the process. So here's my little backup. So the data, you can see them as a stack of 3,644 markers. The length is 34. The height is the number of variables. Can you imagine 3,644 double vectors, one on top of the other? That's taller than Everest. That's the matrix of data. Don't take it from statistical. Don't do your homework. So what are these many, many dimensions that make our double vectors? It's 58,302 transcripts that have been measured in RNA-seq. And just not even 10% of them were measurable in all subjects. Right? It would be nice to use them all. But one of the things that we had to cope with early on is that, below lower limit of quantification. Is it good or bad? That's what it is. Standardized assays on something that is developed in-house, and there's not much that we can do. We could either develop an information model or just go with measurable transcripts. And we started looking into this data, just looking at the measurable.
30% of these are functionally annotated, and this in my immense ignorance of biology and genetics was a big surprise. So we're measuring 50,000 variables, but we have no clue about what they do, what these things are, what they do. But 30% of the measurable ones are. They have been studied to some extent. People have been observing the expression of these particular transcripts are involved in the context of the of certain pathways or certain groups of pathways that we will refer to as processes. A slight nuisance is that each of these samples is also associated to the quality, which is the percentage of actually cancer cells measured in these samples. So we want to know about if there's any association between the baseline expression of certain genes or bits of genes in a cancer cell and response under a given therapy. So we'll better try to make this association specific to cancer cells, not to many cells. But that expression is measured in a mixture, and the only information that we have about the mixture is the percentage of actually cancer cells that are present there. So we cannot decompose the signal, but we at least have some indication of the quality of the sample. So having stared at the stack of the double deckers for a while, and having hacked through the variables in such a way that we have 1626 variables from 58,000, right, just on the basis of measurability, on the basis of annotations. So we can measure and we have some clue of what this would be doing. Then we have, roughly speaking, two analysis options, and you can probably imagine another 5 or 6. But, so bottom up and top down, what do I mean? Bottom up is what the unstructured analysis would look like. So for each of these transcript test, or each of these experiments, the expression between response and non-response.
May I just ask, briefly, what is it about responder and non-responder?
So there's a set of standardized criteria which are called RECIST. And it's essentially, you can measure survival, or you can measure variables such as the expression of some key parameters, or even the imaging. If it's a solid tumor, there is a selection before treatment of a small number of target lesions, and assessment of their size through the time. So the response, a yes or a no, or even a finer characterization response, comes straight from these agreed response criteria.
So that's determined before anything happens?
Well, yes, it's determined independently of this analysis. The response, yes or no, is a given. Yeah.
So it is not a response to any treatment?
It is a response to treatment.
But not with one which you're going to apply.
So that response will be the dependent variable. So what we're trying to do is to understand whether there's an association between this baseline expression. Does the baseline expression cluster or explain, or is it different among the respondents from the non-respondents?
So the respondents are determined after the intervention?
Yes. Yes. So there's many ways of actually defining when, but what we're going to use here is called the best confirmed response, which is two teams of pathologists actually look at the same criteria, and if they come to the same conclusion, the best is confirmed. So then, once we have these dependent variables and the RNA transcript or transcript to X, Y, Z, you know, do your favorite. But then, is that enough for an interpretation? No. So we'll do the map these test statistics into pathways for GSEA, gene set enrichment analysis. Okay? Rank by p-value, for instance, that would be the better way of doing it. imagine this one is not particularly powerful or realistically imagined. In fact, what the question that I have is, can you actually move from the top down? Can you actually first map the annotated transcripts into the pathways and use this annotation within the structure of a binary regression model? Right? So the number of pathways a single transcript mapped in are far, far fewer than the number of transcripts. So we can try to lighten up the learning exercise, try to learn about fewer variables as given by the annotation categories, as opposed to learning about better of things and then try to map them back into a few categories. If you have these categories, embedded in the analysis, learn directly about them, because you cannot learn more. So here the pluses and minuses of bottom up down, so the bottom up is off the shelf, a lot of computations, or this is code, tends to have a lot of power, which I mean power is obvious. And it does not have a built-in interpretive framework. After you've done it, then go to the annotation framework, map things in, and try to figure out what happened. Top down again uses annotation for the analysis, and therefore you can use a structured annotation based model for phrasing your quantitative decision rules. So if this pathway is significant, then I will do something. The minus is that, as we've seen there, a minority of these transcripts might be annotated, so we have to, in a way, a lot of annotation knowledge. To me, as far as I understand it, what we're chopping away is not really actionable, because if a few transcripts show up, but discriminating very, 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 very different between responders and responsible, we have no clue what they do. In clinical development, we wouldn't accept them how to use them. We would then stop with the back of these examples. It would not be relevant for the development of the drug itself.
That's a question. That's a question.
Yeah. Please, feel free to disagree.
I mean, practically, question. You can measure it. Still, use it. If it is informative, obviously nothing is informative when you have 44 cases and 1,000 variables, but if it is informative and you don't know what it is, it's still practically useful.
Yeah, I don't know what it would take to actually base the exclusion criteria on the basis of evidence that transcript from unknown function seems to discriminate responders and responders. I think it would trigger a number of interesting questions, but I don't think it would be immediately actionable. People will have perplexities. At least I would have perplexities as well. So if you see things in this way, bottom up versus top down, what is it that we should use? And by the way, when I talk about annotations, what do I mean? There's a number of annotation systems. Here's two of them, and the representation of one. There's the gene ontology annotations, which to me, since I'm not a computer biologist, it's a complex vocabulary of a lot of stuff that would be and it will be very interesting to use for this kind of top-down analysis. But it's at the moment a little beyond my reach. So there's another annotation system that is somewhat simplified, which is a MetaSignature database, MCDB, which is what we've seen here. So transcripts are annotated in 50 pathways on the horizontal axis, which are further grouped into 8 processes. Okay? So there's 1626 genes. Each of them is mapped into one or more than one such pathways. And the pathways are further grouped, for example, what is called the cellular component pathway is nothing but the union of macular junction, apical surface, and peristalsis.
So I can show it on a slide, I can at least spell the name of the pathway.
certain things like a signaling, there is IL 6 pathway, there is maybe which is known for the gene, and can we spell IL 2 and other interviews? So there are a few things that even if you're not a specialist, you can start seeing what are you actually missing so much. And I'm using this.
Is it the red?
Red, no, white is yes.
Yeah. So accelerating point goes into 1, 2, 3.
Without it goes into 1, 2, 3. So you can imagine that one gene then will be mapped into one and more often. All of the genes are mapped in a number of pathways within one gene domain. And then those pathways are mapped into a number of biological processes. So the same measurement, RNA expression, will contribute to our measured expression of many pathways and even more biological processes. Why? Because we're taking this as a given. This is the known, currently known artificial system. Simplest one that I can use to just about start assessing the potential use of this drop down like this in is the model in a culture form.
So here you have response, yes or no, is it at least a partial response for beta that those resist criteria that also mentioned. So this one is a binary variable. What is the problem? Somebody will have a response. We're going to use an intercept. We're going to use this percent of the cancer cell as sample weights. That's one way to use that. You know that one gene sample had 0.5% cancer cells. How much do you want to weight it in an analysis which is supposed to infer the relation between the expression in a cancer cell and response better because it was better than cancer cell. And other samples. 100%, well, that's very important. You can imagine this is a binary regression, and these are your main gaps. It's a function of the RNC 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 6. However, these are connected to the 50 pathways in gray arrows, which I know, which I've just shown you on the previous slide. We know which maps back. And we also know which biological process will not delay maps from each map. Right. So what we'll try to do is then learn about this probability or explain the observed responses using the topmost category, which is the most parsimonious set of variables that I can use as far as the information system goes. Estimation, there we go. Magic one word, phrase, or maximum amount of information. As you can imagine, any more than
yeah. Just can you give an example? What do you mean by process? Is it cell division or
signaling, proliferation, generically called pathway?
This eight things.
You know, you see that link, the second one? You've got all the details there. At this level, I am a user of a published annotation system. Immune is self-explanatory. What they actually mean with pathway and signaling.
So what you take RNA-seq data and classify each case?
There are a couple of equations that you watch. If after the equation is not clear. So just before the equation, we'll just finish with the estimation and then again the classes of minus is sort of mass and right phase. You can estimate yourself, Emily, you know, 30 times a minute. You can estimate the process of the functions is 8. Remember that the sample size is 34, so in maximum likelihood, even if you're trying to estimate 50 things out of 34, you're going to have problems. So the only thing that we can estimate using the base is
base, enhancing the processes, set coefficients, in theory given the contribution of a single transcript at the price of specifying a reasonable and useful price. So this is the equation, your yi, which is the response, is the bully, sample I, and let's just focus on the full one here. You have your favorite link function with no distinct others. So that's each element with a covariance, xi, main things xi. What is this xi? Is the n times p baseline expression. However, the beta, the regression coefficients, are you using a second order thing? You say, well, these regression coefficients are centered around the binary matrix that represents the mapping of the RNC transcripts into pathways, times what's really driving things is not beta, is a gamma. That's really the sort of the regression coefficients that we have. Z is a binary mapping of each transcript. You need to graph your way through six four pathways and simply do that in this direction. Each gene, each transcript, contributes to the first, the fourth, and the seventh. The second one contributes to others. So if you take your X and multiply by Z, you just accomplish this mapping. However, here I'm just random effects, some individual effects of the intergene. If you have this prior is on the straw man, that's pretty bad, but that's not what you write down. You write down normal, normal with I'm going one step further, just to take a look at that interesting. Well, this gamma, this is 50-dimensional, 50, but what's really driving is not even the pathways, is the groups of pathways. W is again another binary matrix that represents the mapping of pathways into processes, into brain processes. And this delta here is really what we're after, with prior stabilized symptoms, zero with some small awareness of trees that are even being developed for reasons. If you don't like random effects, then this way it's the same link function, but now the linear predictor is a matrix C how many times times R delta. And what is whatever we should see is nothing but the n times the matrix times the mapping into the pathway times the mapping into the processes. And you end up with n, which is the 4 times 8 matrix of aggregated explanatory variables. How are they aggregated? How is this dimensionality reduction accomplished? Simply leveraging the current annotation system. What do we learn? We learn regressions. Coefficients delta, which is the association or the way in which one set of pathways, one biological process, the expression of one biological process, cumulative of all the transcripts populating it, do or do not influence the cognitive response. Okay? So nothing magic, just leveraging structurally through the multiples. Evidence that we hope is reliable, although it's not definitive. You know, annotations are developing all the time. But we bring it in so that a study that appeared to be completely hopeless, 36.4 double numbers, now it's reduced relatively anyway, but in a way that's workable. So just none regression coefficients, intercept percent.
Is the assumption that it's only the eight processes which are capable of being informative?
Sorry, say it again.
Is the assumption here that it's only the eight processes that are capable of being informative or what?
So, more than an assumption is one way to interpret data using a framework that is out there.
Yes, it is an assumption. If you come up with an annotation system or a system that can actually boil down these many, many thousands of single transcripts into an aggregated set of categories that we can learn about without putting tens of thousands of people through preprints, then...
And what limits the sample size you can draw?
I've got a slide about this. Yeah. Can I try? Yeah. So then, so which one should we use? I mean, the bottom up and top down using these notations was the thing, right? So here on the left-hand side, I have an estimate of the false positive probability. What do I mean? For each sample size and gradient, and for each method, which is one of these colors, what is the probability that risk rambling the labels, the respondents and non-responders, and using the reduced model, not the full model, so no random effects, right? What is the probability that at least one of these process effects will be significant? Will be p-value less than 0.1 as significant structure. So Ks is Kolmogorov standard. False positive, and then you apply what we know about the false discovery rate correction. This is called this is Federico, and these two essentially two these are otherwise zero rate corrections. The whole completely standard corrections for false positives. So you see that, for example, the n=4. Your dramatic false positives are effectively, you know, lowered by the false discovery rate correction, and are even lowered even more as expected using a value-wise correction. Now, what I'm doing here, I'm not only risk-branding, I'm also bootstrapping, resampling with replacement from Y34 into either with less 20 or far. You can imagine many other kind of simulation scenarios to use the data so as to base the assessment of the false positives. I'm not using completely poor maths to re-scramble and resample. So if I do that, I can take a look at how this false positive evolves and just climbs up as sample size goes up, because it's the probability of at least one. These two pockets here are the top-down annotation based approaches. And you can clearly see that the difference, especially as the sample size climbs, in false positive land is major. Or the chromatic false positive, even using the standard way of controlling the models. Far less, you would like even less, but nevertheless, far less using these more structured approaches. This orange one is the regression that does take.
Don't claim that I understand everything, but my feeling in this part that I described right now, that the more samples you use,
yes,
the less power you get.
Well,
it's somehow counterintuitive.
So the more sample I use, using this rescrambling and resampling, the more likely it is that I'm going to pick up at least one, right? False positive.
I don't challenge your output of your procedure, but it's not consistent with commonly used procedures. Commonly, when you have more samples, it sort of leads to more power, I mean less probability of false positives.
So you can see at least a part of this on true positives, which is a function of sample size. So what am I doing here? I'm doing something that to the experimental people is kind of familiar, that is, I am spiking the data with one gene which truly discriminates respondents and non-respondents. It's a
a bit like an assay development, you spike a mixture with a known amount or a component, and when you measure it, you want to see it there. So what we see here is that, again, all these mechanisms, the true quality approach goes up, and this structured approach is actually taking a little bit longer for the true quality to go up. Why? Well, because this one gene, which if you want the worst case scenario, only one gene in 1626, this one gene gets mixed up in this linear transformations in this mapping with a bunch of other genes which are noise. So in this case, your single gene hypothesis testing picks up that one gene a lot better than the structure. So let me just fly through some of these results. One, two. So this one is just results on based on real data. This is the estimated probability of response. Bill is non-responder, Ray is responder. Here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 responders. And the size of the dot is the weight, so the percentage of cancer cells. For example, these three blue dots are up there. The percentage of cells was basically zero, borderline zero, so I'm representing them. Right? And they're clear mistakes, but it's for one thing, because the weight associated with that data in the regression is zero. We're basically not learning from that. So it's not surprising that we get the problem. So all these are classified correctly and so on and so forth. So your weighted accuracy is about 90%, 91%. Where does it come from? These are the regression coefficients. So there's a couple of processes which seem to lower the ratio, the odds ratio. So yeah, essentially, they could just use that if the baseline expression of this category of transcript goes up, then the values. If the baseline expression of these types goes up, it is bigger, right? Or the response, or the original response goes up. Tons of uncertainty around this point estimates, as we expect. Did my toe into significance? This one, that one, is the null distribution of the weight accuracy of that classification of the essentially the weight. I'm using as weights the actual weights, the percentage of cancer cells. So it's centered at 50%, is slightly broader than the null distribution of the So this is the accuracy of that regression, and this null distribution that appears there for Ray, we have a lot of significance compared to the null model, we're doing so much better. Yes, of course, we're using 16, 26, 69 for variables. So this null distribution is the null distribution of accuracy if you have, well, essentially under scrambling with 16, 26 variables. Just by chance, your accuracy goes up. So the significance of this value compared to this non-distribution is far, far less. And actually, given the sample size, right, the underpoweredness of the study is evident here in that no accuracy value short of 98% would have been true value less than 0.5. When you see that, you say, well, the only case in which I would mildly rejoice is the case of proof of classification. And even then, from the perspective of this non-distribution, evidence will not be that strong. So, I'm taking 5 extra minutes, sorry, Nikki. So,
carry on.
So, these gene annotations enable the quantification, especially the interpretation of aggregate. A bit like a PCA, but done using a structure which has some on top of that, since we have a regression model, we can actually show these plots that are not fully clear, but at least they give a sense of your regression characteristics of the model under current and other sample sizes. Why is that important? Because we can then go back and say, well, if you're worried about a false positive, meaning at least one of these genes showing up in the wrong way, really important to articulate the design used based on the minuses. The minus is that these annotations are not carved in stone. This is ongoing work in biology. What is annotated today is a subset of what will be annotated tomorrow, and there's no guarantee that the same annotations will actually be used. So it comes to no surprise, but we're actually relying on the current state of the science.
And what kind of bias did you choose for the regression coefficients?
The results that I've shown you, I have not used quite massive amount.
Yeah.
So not even for the deltas.
Well, I was actually going to write that question.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I did not see anywhere where a Bayesian analysis took place.
Yes. It didn't.
Yeah.
So you see the title is Bayesian structural, and this is the structure. There's some considerations and experiments that are done with Lassoon priors. So it's a way of constraining the regression coefficients. But again, with this sample size, I didn't see any clear advantage of constraining the deltas around zero. Just, again, the underpoweredness is too pronounced, even for these sort of conservative priors to be used. What we would really need is some true informative priors, and nobody has.
So, then again, we need 150 samples even to learn 8 aggregated effects, and to get some name for it, it's there. What we do, well, integrated analysis across multiple studies is one way to go. However, in the case in which we are unable to gather that sample size of 100 or more in one study, which is the reality, in the early studies, there's no way that we can get that sample size. In late development, yes, but not in phase 1-2 quality as I thought.
So we can think about this integrated analysis, but we will need to articulate the model further, at least one level of the hierarchy, to take into account potential heterogeneity across studies, and not just do assume by definition everything's extremely true. That's what I have to say, and maybe we will let Nikki, if it's urgent.
I guess the question I was going to ask was about classification of response.
Yes.
I'm putting it into an artificial binary situation,
yes,
where we know that resist response is not necessarily predicted by human measurements, could be used as a continuous variable.
Yes. So yes, we also have PFS, for example, in this study. You can definitely think about a Fox model equivalent to try and tease the effect of PFS.
So thanks very much for Charles to come in and talk. I know Fabio sort of comes to these meetings fairly regularly, so it's a good chance. I've probably had 10 slides. I've got about 50 here, but a lot of them are backups. And as I have vested interest in getting home tonight, I probably won't go through everything, but yeah, we'll see how we go. So, yes, our sort of joint title is that Fabio alluded to. Fabio's been sort of talking about one way of incorporating external information into clinical trials through sort of structured information around sort of the annotations and gene pathways. I'm going to talk around other work we've been doing around actually incorporating other external data on similar endpoints and some of these areas into, again, small clinical trials. So I'm just trying to bring in that external information and doing that via informative priors. So my bit's got baked into the part in as well. So sort of, the challenges we face in clinical development, increasingly trials are taking place in small populations, and that could be in rare diseases. Paediatric drug development is a big area of focus at the moment in terms of sort of carrying out clinical studies in paediatric populations, but also other areas like sort of targeted subgroups, and that would be oncology, clearly, or other disease areas. It might be at a broad level, a disease may be fairly common, but when you start to look at sort of personalised medicine or subgroups, then you get down to much smaller potential populations. And even, again, in sort of more common areas, the challenge of actually recruiting patients, particularly sort of neurological, sort of Alzheimer's, those kind of disease areas, that the burden on patients to actually take part in trials can actually lead to high levels of dropout, so there's a big challenge around actually recruiting and maintaining and keeping patients in trials. So, it is a challenge, not just around the cost, but there's a lot of challenges around designing trials that sort of meet conventional entry standards in terms of power and type 1 error control. So we need a balance between what's necessary for providing sort of high quality evidence of drug effects and actually what's feasible and possible. And on the plus side, pharmaceutical industry has got massive data, thousands of patients worth of data, and it's sitting in our databases from historical trials that we carry out. So it's really a question of how we try and make use of some of that information more formally to reduce the size or the risk of the new trial. And so
agree that the pharmaceutical industry does have a huge amount of data, but to what extent is that data a biased set?
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the key questions in terms of how do we select what data may or may not be appropriate or relevant to try and use in particular.
So when your data gets into the pharmaceutical data set, it's because there's something unusual about you or something special about you. You've got involved in a trial or you've been reported from a hospital or whatever. To get into there, you're not a random member of the population.
Sure, but we're not necessarily trying to... I mean, I'm not talking so much here around trying to sort of use external data that enables us to sort of generalise to the general population. It's more around what can we do. So one of the examples which actually probably won't play is first of all the pediatric drug development. I think it's an example where we're trying to use information on control subjects, placebo subjects from previous trials. The trial we're now designing, the subjects that are being randomised into that trial are not necessarily a random, there's a sort of set of people who are genetic criteria, there are a certain type of patient. We're actually trying to match historical data on those types of patients, so we're not necessarily trying to get a completely representative set of data on the general population. But trying to identify what is a relevant set of data to borrow is still a difficult question.
Okay.
So there's two areas we're particularly focusing on. One is around pediatric drug development, and I'll spend some time talking about that. So here, what we're actually trying to do is to borrow information from adults on the efficacy and potentially safety of the drug in adults, and then use that to sort of extrapolate to the efficacy in children. And then the second setting is where we're looking at the drug development in adults, but trying to supplement or replace control patients in a trial with patients treated by
And I think you, those of you who are familiar with the platform trials, some umbrella trials, and it's a sort of similar concept to there, when you've got a sort of control arm that's maybe shared across several different apps and arms, and that control arm, you know, some of the controls are randomised content previously with a new active arm, and you've potentially got controls that were randomised earlier in the platform. So it's just an extension of those ideas. So as I say, I think I'll focus on personal distributed UCB, the sort of daily methodology we're using. I've got two case studies. I don't think I'll get time to get to the second one, so I'll focus initially on the analysis of adolescent efficacy to support a paediatric submission. Okay, so we're using Bayesian, sort of what's called Bayesian dynamic borrowing methods to combine the external information with the information in the new trial. So, and this is, these slides are my sort of picture versions of Bayesian. The ones I use when I'm not talking to statisticians, but you know, I've got used to liking pictures. So we've got some historical data, if you like our source population, and if you like, we can use that to generate a predictive price distribution for what we expect in the setting of the new trial. So in blue here is our sort of predictive price based on our historical information. The red distribution is then what we see in the data we collect on that same response in the new trial. And you know, we apply the Bayesian magic and we end up with our cost distribution, which is the black, which is a more precise estimate of the response here based on combining the new trial data and the historic evidence. And we're happy because we've gained sort of power and precision by doing that sort of combining. But the challenge comes when the historic information we're expecting to use turns out to be very different from the data. What the data we collect turned out to be very different from the historic information. And so the standard Bayesian updating will give us a posterior on the right over there, which you gain that precision, but it's sort of sitting slap bang in the middle of the information we have in the historical data and the information in the new trial. And showing that to the clinicians, and they really don't like it. It sort of doesn't feel like it's representing really what we believe around the mean response. And, yeah, I think you can argue about whether that's an appropriate interpretation, but it's certainly a very common reaction to that sort of potential conflict between the prior information we're proposing to use and the neutral data.
The black curve at the bottom would surely be wider in practice. I can see you're keeping it the same shape. It's still the simple, but it's surely be wider. There's disagreement between the prior.
But your posterior precision gain, you're gaining. So this is the posterior from the mean. Your posterior estimate of the mean is based on the information coming from both sources. So the precision of that is the same. Because you've basically got the same precision coming from the prior and the precision coming from the life.
So the question is that it should be wider, and it will be wider, on the slide.
Yes. Yeah.
You're saying it's not wider?
No. Is it discussion, so I'm using this discussion in all the time. Actually, that's a good illustration. And I would consider, maybe you will consider later, another thing. Here, if we consider axis, not x-axis, as an effect size, let's say, mean response, you, in both cases, drawing the blue, I mean the prior, on the left side of the red. So in that sense, your sort of prior information was less in favor of whatever effect size, high effect size. In that case, it is rather attenuating the results. And I think in any practical case, when we look for prior to support whatever our expectations, it should be to the right of the red, if you do these illustrations, if I just don't mix it up. So in this illustration, I would expect if this blue thing is much far to the right of the red, And if it's conceptually biological, this is where it supports things. Now it just intimates whatever we see.
Yeah, this is purely illustrative, and I mean, it's
kind of one of the things. Whatever it means, yeah.
If it's a bad outcome, then, yeah, this is necessarily sort of better. So, you know, it's not meant to imply any sort of direction effects. It's just meant to be sort of capturing what happens if you essentially just pull the data, your historical information and your current information. When those two sources are conflicting in terms of what they're telling you about the meaning. So, sort of one way to sort of try and robustify our sort of inference and the way we're using that historical information is to build in a sort of a second component which sort of captures the possibility that the historical information is not relevant. And this actually comes with, this is not a new idea, in sort of the Cromwell's rule idea comes from Dennis Lindley, sort of advice that if you're expressing a sort of prior belief, you must always acknowledge the possibility that your belief, you've got to be very confident belief, but there's always got to be some possibility that what you believe is actually not correct, unless your belief is being expressed about something which has absolute certainty. So, the idea is that you sort of can think of two priors. One is the prior assuming historical data that you're plotting out its relevance in the new setting, and then you've got a second one which is the sort of the safety valve, or in case we've got it wrong and the data's not relevant. So we have a sort of a, essentially a flat prior, it's more quiet and not much at the moment. And then we can put these two together into a mixture distribution with an appropriate weight, so the weight is W on the historical information, what minus that on the sort of available information, and obviously depending on the way you choose, your sort of mixture prior is sort of more or less peaked and more or less heavy tail. So this is essentially, if you like, classifying your prior range using a sort of a heavy tail to your distribution. And when you do that, going back to exactly the same scenario I had on the previous slide, so it's the same historical information, but now we've got the mixture prior, so it's got a 50% weight on the historic information, 50% on the flat component. We've got the same new study data, which is consistent with historical information, so in that case, your posterior distribution actually upweights the historical amount it's borrowing, and you get pretty much the same posterior as you would have done with the simple kind of conventional-based analysis putting full weight on. So you gain the precision you borrow from historical data. But in the second scenario where our new trial data was very different from the historical information, so same mixture prior to start with, but we see this data, our posterior now is much more diffuse because the mixture, effectively what it's saying is, well, this new trial data is sort of much more consistent with sort of the flat distribution, the distribution saying that historically it's not relevant. So it's picking more of that up and it's downweighting even further the historic information. So your posterior looks much more like the information rate distribution. You've got a little bump here, this is still picking up a little bit of the quite the most is coming and reflecting the new chart data. So you've sort of robustified against sort of borrowing potentially inappropriate information. So that was the sort of the pictorial version of the Fair equations. This is just a sort of simple illustration for a binary endpoint. One of the nice things about these mixture priors is that for these four fairly common settings in clinical trials, we can actually do this in a sort of conjugate way. So for a binary outcome, so your sort of parameter of interest is the theta of probability of success, the probability of response, for example. Then you set your mixture priors as sort of mixture two beta distributions, and you've got the top one, which is your informative prior, which could have been drawn from a previous trial in the same population. For a sample size 300, you had 210 responders, so you set that was beta 210-90 prior. And then you've got your sort of vague component, which we've here got as a beta 1-1, so it's a sort of a flat uniform prior. I know you're likely to your new trial, so you've got 100 subjects in the new trial.
when your posterior distribution, applying that mixture by with the one end of likelihood, is then just a mixture of two updated betas. So your posterior is also a mixture of betas. Each one is a standard conjugate updating of the beta components. And then the sort of like the new part is then the weights you put on those components also get updated. So this is the dynamic learning part of these mixture varieties. So you learn about the weights. So you may start off by saying, I'm going to put 50% weight on each component. If the data are consistent with the informative component, what will happen in this updating is that it will up the weight. So you'll end up with, say, 80% weight on the informative posterior component, and only 20% here. Whereas if the data are very inconsistent with the informative component, it will downweight and you'll put much more weight on the vague component of the posterior. So that's how that sort of dynamic weighting occurs.
What does the criterion define the best, the optimal point? Your W is kind of optimal, so I mean, most consistent with what you observe. Is there any rule?
So this updating of the weight is all standard Bayes theorem, so Bayes in updating. And actually, I think the next slide. Yeah. So another way of thinking about this is essentially a sort of positive model probability. So you can always think about this as a model choice sort of setting, and actually then model averaging. So you can think about you've got two alternative hypotheses, if you like, for the trial. So one hypothesis for model one is that the response rate in the historical data is equal to the response rate in the new setting. The alternative model two is that the response rate in the historical and the new populations are totally different. So they don't have information. So you can think those two different models. So the models differ by the priors you're putting on rather than the likelihood you're receiving. So you've got a prior on the response parameter under model one, the informative prior, and the alternative failure prior. And then you specify a sort of weight or a prior belief on each of those two hypotheses. And then you get a marginal prior, which is a mixture of those two according to the prior weight you put on. And then in terms of the updating, once you get the observed data, then say you're updating each of the conditional posterior under the two different models separately. But then your posterior model probabilities are updated by Bayes' theorem, so it's a standard application of Bayes' theorem. So essentially, it depends on the marginal likelihood of the data you observe in your new trial under each of your two model hypotheses. So effectively, it's like, so it's the ratio of Bayes' marginal likelihood under the two is your Bayes factor. So it's a standard Bayesian sort of model. So you could then take sort of the model sort of selection approach and you pick the model with the highest posterior model probability. So if you get a higher probability on the model that comes from the informative variety, you say I'm going to borrow it all and go with that one. If you get a high probability on the vague component, you say I'm going to throw it all away. But of course that ignores the uncertainty around how much evidence is there that the vague components or the historical one is more relevant. So the mixture prior approach is effectively a model averaging approach. You're averaging the posterior two models onto the two priors. So in terms of how much the weights get updated, it's going to depend on effectively the sample size and the amount of discrepancy. And a key is, like I said earlier, you've got the vague component, which is going to show the flat prior. Of course, because this is sort of like a Bayesian model choice, you can't be a proper prior, so you do have to be very careful around the choice of that vague component, because the vaguer you make that prior, the less chance you'll ever have of the data looking plausible under it. So your marginal likelihood of the data under the vague component gets smaller and smaller, the more vague that prior is. So that can affect the way weights happen, so you need to be a bit careful about that. And that's one of the things we sort of learned when we're trying to apply this, that actually you can't just say, oh, it's vague, and sort of put a very large variance on it. It actually matters how large that large variance is. Okay, so sort of talk through some of the examples we've been using this sort of mixture prior approach. So say one area I think it is potentially quite appealing is to use it in pediatric drug development. And so just so like in terms of way drug development works, I mean typically we'll develop, so I'm focusing here not on drugs where we're looking at paediatric diseases and it's purely being developed for paediatric use. This is where we're developing a drug in adults. There's now there's a regulatory requirement that any drug that's developed and licensed in adults, you have to have a paediatric development plan as well to provide supporting evidence around, you know, for any disease where potentially whether disease also applies in children and whether drug could potentially be used in children, you have to have a paediatric drug development plan to provide evidence around the usage and dosage in children. And depending on the nature of the disease, so sometimes the paediatric development plan is just based on sort of PKPD, sort of modelling and extrapolation of the dose, sort of the allometric scaling, sort of based on body weight, sort of from adults to children. When there's a very, very clear scientific knowledge around the sort of disease process in adults and children, and we sort of know that it's effectively the disease manifests in the same way in children. We understand the pharmacology, so there's a very good, clear rationale for why we can just base sort of the dosing in children and the expected clinical benefit in children on what we already know in adults. There are a lot of situations, there's uncertainty, you know, there's differences around sort of how the drug pathway might behave in children, there's differences around the disease, the endpoints in children. And so there's often a requirement to collect some clinical evidence, sort of evidence of clinical efficacy in children. So we actually have to run clinical trials in children to sort of collect information on the clinical endpoints. So the question then becomes, well, can we, you know, because it's so difficult to carry out trials in children, often, you know, there's fewer children typically with the disease anyway. So to what extent can we use information we already have on the efficacy and safety in adults to support the information we then collect in children so we can combine them to sort of create an overall package of evidence? And you know, at the moment it's very hand-wavy in terms of how that's often done. It's sort of, you know, there's a sort of scientific rationale around sort of the similarity, but then you know, you collect a bit of data in children and you try and put it together, but it's quite subjective in terms of how that's interpreted. So using this sort of based in borrowing approach is perhaps one way to try and more formalise and quantify what assumptions we're making around the relevance of the adult information to enable us to borrow and conclude efficacy in children. So this is an example that we did at GSK, where in fact we actually did propose what's a full extrapolation, so we didn't carry out any separate clinical trials in children. But it actually turned out that we had a small number of adolescents who were included in our adult phase 3 trial. So this was the pivotal trial to use registration of the drug in adults. We collected a small amount of information in adolescent subjects. And so the first step in this sort of extrapolation process, we then used that information to try and support the case that the efficacy in the adolescents was similar to what we've seen in the adults. So we have 34 adolescent subjects in the phase 3 pivotal studies, and so the question was, well, can we do something a bit more formal and quantitative to show that the information we collected in those 34 adolescents is consistent with the efficacy information we got from the adults? So the primary endpoint was a sort of disease flare measure. So it's a sort of a rate ratio where lower is good, so you're reducing the rate of the sort of disease flare. So in the adult subjects, so nearly 1,100 adults are observed, which rate ratio was 0.46. It's statistically significant. So the registration of the drug was based on that adult evidence. In the 34 adolescent subjects, we saw a similar magnitude of effect, but obviously very wide confidence intervals because it's 34 subjects, so very precise. So can we do anything more than just say, well, okay, point estimate similar, it's trending in the right direction, therefore we're going to conclude that the efficacy in adolescents is the same as with adults.
Could you test for an interaction with age continuously?
You could, but it's not going to be power. Yes, and an age, I think, I can't remember the various analysis, but I think the adjustment for age was done in the model as well, but I mean the primary analysis wasn't adjusted for age. But yeah, you could test for that, but I don't, again, it's sort of how do you interpret it, what's it sort of, if it's not significant, what's it telling you? So, I mean, I sort of, you know, one of the things, and this is not the only thing we sort of did, but one of the sort of approaches to build the evidence package was to sort of, if you like, stress test this extrapolation assumption. So our sort of hypothesis is that we can extrapolate the efficacy between adults, we can extrapolate that to the adolescent population, essentially claiming that the efficacy is similar in adolescents. So we sort of say split the data from the trial into the adult and the adolescents, and we're going to take the adult information as our prior, as the informative component and a robust mixture prior, and then vary the weight we put on that component, and sort of, if you like, do almost like a tipping point analysis to see, like, what's the lowest weight we need to put on that adult information in order for the posterior distribution, once we have in the adolescents, to achieve statistical significance. So to produce plots sort of like this, which is basically shown on the left-hand side, the black is the adolescent-only estimate of the rate ratio. It's 95% greater than interval with 7% value prior, so effectively the same as the confidence interval. Over on the right, the red is the estimate just based on the adult information, and then the blue are showing you these sort of like tipping point analysis where we vary the weight from 0 all the way up to 1 on the mixture prior. So that's the weight we're putting on the adult information. So on the left we put 0 weight, that's effectively the same as just taking the adolescents alone. Over on the right, once we put full weight on the adults, because there's so much adult data, it's effectively swapping the adolescent data, so it's essentially the same as the adult-only analysis. And then what we're looking for is, well, how far do we have to push this in terms of how much weight we've got on the adults before we sort of dip below the horizontal line, which is a rate ratio of 1, so we achieve sort of significance at the conventional sort of level. And we can see that it's somewhere around about 65% prior weight. So the sort of interpretation of that is to say that, you know, this is a retrospective analysis, but we can use this to sort of say, well, if we were willing to assume, you know, at least sort of 2-1 prior or 65% prior probability in favour of extrapolation, then the data we've collected in the adolescents combined with that prior belief, you know, confidence in an ability to extrapolate is sufficient to then conclude evidence adolescents. So it at least provides us a way of quantifying how much reliance we're placing on the adult information in order to claim efficacy in the adolescents, as opposed to just looking at the, you know, the sort of
interesting data. Sorry, can you go back to that graph? It has an interesting feature in that the lower points on the blue lines level out pretty much where you put your tipping point, whereas the upper end points are still declining until almost at the end. So there's some sort of sense in which the lower limit of the rate of risk is better determined for these data than the upper end.
Yeah, so that lower limit is being driven by the adult information. The upper limit is the kind of, if you remember back to the sort of little illustration, go back to it here, it's the bump here that's coming, because the adolescent observed data was slightly less configured, so the effect in the adults was 0.46, whereas 0.6 in the adolescents. So you've got a little bump coming from this sort of, you know, we just take the focus on the adolescent information, so that's what's driving that upper tail, whereas the sort of the lower tail of those plots is coming from the adults. And then another way you can look at it, which is sort of that's thinking about sort of the model probability, so we can say, okay, for the prior weights, our prior belief in the adults being relevant and extrapolate, given for a given prior belief, how much does the data change that from the adolescents, how much, you know, in terms of our posterior relief. And if you look at various points, I'll just mark on here again the same. So if you have prior belief of 65% on the adult information to be relevant, then the adolescent data increases that to somewhere around about 90%. So starting at 65% belief, the data have shifted our belief and our confidence up to 90% that we can extrapolate. So again, it's just a way to try and quantify, you know, how are we using the adult information in terms of if we want to conclude that we've got efficacy in adolescents as well.
That's a posterior probability advantage.
Yes.
It's very different from extracting the weights from the data. You wouldn't be able to use this information to check efficacy.
Well, this was part of the submission package to the regulators to claim efficacy in adolescents. So this wasn't the primary evidence, as it were. There's a whole package that's put together which has the scientific rationale for why we believe we can extrapolate. But then there's a supportive quantitative evidence to back that up in the study. So this is being used. So, what you can't estimate obviously is your prior beliefs, and that's that is the difficult thing. And certainly from a regulation point of view, getting regulators comfortable with expressing or somebody expressing in prior judgment around that. But actually, they're doing it all the time because implicitly there is a judgment around how relevant we think the adult information is, how confident are we can extrapolate, because we don't have standalone evidence in the pediatrics or the adolescents. So we're happy to pull in the sort of judgment. This is one way of trying to make it more explicit. I think that's what we're trying to argue here. I wouldn't have claimed we've won that argument yet, but
That was a question I had, is how did the regulators respond to this type of analysis, did they?
So the paediatric submission was approved,
right,
the whole package. The comments, I mean, we didn't get very many comments explicitly about this, this is only one component of it. There was one comment from the reviewers that said, well, it's obvious the higher your prior weight, the higher your posterior weight.
Yes.
So I think they misunderstood the purpose of why we're doing it.
Mm.
So I think there's definitely a lot of education still needs to be done around what does this add to the sort of the evidence package.
Mm.
But I think that one of the other comments was a bit more sort of, yes, that's it's useful to get quantified, but we're definitely not there yet in terms of this thing.
But did you elicit this pre?
No, so this was a retrospective analysis. This was one of those, because we happen to have some adolescent data in the adult study.
I'm just wondering how you think that would be to elicit. It's quite a difficult probability.
Yes, exactly. And I think that is a challenge. I've got a few more slides where I'm trying to sort of think about that, so maybe I can come back to that in a moment.
That's definitely sort of in the capacity of a clinician who would think about it. People definitely would like some quantitative measure in what degree we relied on evidence from adults compatibly to collected evidence from adolescents. So the aim of it, to give some quantitative measure, is definitely practical and useful. The question is there any standard ways of doing it, or is it the first sort of exercise in trying to develop such measure?
I think the answer is there's no standard ways of doing it. I think there's there are other ways, and there's been quite a lot of interest both from regulators and sort of pharma and academics around this in the last couple of years. So both the European Medicines Agency and the FDA in the US have both had sort of workshops and have put out position papers around extrapolation for adults and pediatrics and approaches to doing it. Both agencies have mentioned Bayesian approaches as being one way of doing it. There are other, perhaps simpler things you can do. So another thing in the EMA paper is, well, you can just increase the type 1 error that you're prepared to accept. Which, you're doing this because obviously when you're borrowing this sort of information, that does potentially inflate your type 1 error. But again, as well, okay, do I inflate it to 5%, 10%, 15%? How do you, that's to the judgment again. Another thing is, you know, you could change it to non-inferiority study, you could maybe widen non-inferiority margin. So there are other things, other ways people have tried to sort of simplify and do this.
It's not about ratio significance and quotation marks. What I personally like to do is that it gives you a quantitative measure on what degree you relied on previous knowledge and compatibility required. Was this somehow implemented earlier? Any measure?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean,
I'm going to publish it. Sorry? I'm going to publish it in terms of education.
Yes, in fact, there's a PSI, which is Advantage for Statisticians, sort of organisation, is organising a webinar in about 3 weeks' time where we're going to discuss a paper published by co-authors, including the regulators, where they're talking about Bayesian net history extrapolation. And I mean, not this approach, just sort of a meta-analysis approach, but we're having a discussion meeting, and these are some of the ideas I'm going to try and discuss at that meeting, will be some of these. So and that's not formally published, but we've then got plans to sort of try and then write this up and sort of publish it. So at some point, hopefully, we'll check this. So
when you publish it, it will trigger scrutiny of it, and then it will become acceptable by regulators.
So you let the data tell you about these weighting parameters, weight on the adult data, when does it lie?
So you have to choose this. Once you've chosen this, the data then tells you this. So that's the data is coming in via seeing how much you're increasing or decreasing from where you started. So given your prior belief, you now collect some data, what have that data told you about whether your prior belief it supports your primary, it will increase the weight, it doesn't support your primary, it will decrease the weight. So that's where the data are coming in, but obviously the higher your prior weight start with, and of course the higher your posterior weight. So it's what you're measuring is the relative change rather than the absolute weight.
Well, the relative change is in effect the likely regression of the data.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just wondering what about the study design and so on, because that pretty much comes from realizing the vertical sample size, right?
Yeah.
Can we incorporate, very quick question, can we incorporate some this one into study design?
So that's the thing we've been working on, and
right.
Let me sort of move on to that. So, yeah, I think trying to design a prospective pediatric study where we're setting out to carry out a clinical trial in children, how do we design it with the intent of using the added information we've got? Range.
So then you can say how many adults sample, what's the sample size for the adults we require.
So this sort of tipping point approach is shown is useful for retrospective assessment or for sensitivity analysis at the end. And in terms of designing, we need to pre-specify the prior weights, the sample size, the operating factors, and so on. So this is bit of a brain dump at the moment in terms of what I think we can do. We haven't tried this yet. So any thoughts? But and there's nothing magic here. I mean, it's just really it's more about thinking about how do we communicate to the decision makers and the clinicians, the regulators, the way we come up with the choices of the different inputs. So I think the design stage, first thing is we're going to assume that the annual prior is known. And at some point it will be because we will only carry out the trial in children if had approval on the adult drug. So if the adult phase 3 trials don't show any efficacy, we won't file for approval, and then we don't need to do the trials in children. So you're sort of taking it as given that we have information from the adult trials, and that would be supportive of efficacy in adults. So we've got that adult prior. So what we need to do now for the pediatric study is we need to specify a prior weight. We're going to put on that adult information, which corresponds to our belief that we can extrapolate, and that needs to be based on scientific arguments, biological arguments, knowledge of the pharmacology of the drug. So that has to have a scientific rationale behind it. And that's still, I think, the biggest challenge is, how do you translate that scientific rationale into a number? There are prior education approaches that we are using in other contexts. GSK, I think, would be useful to try in this context. And then we need to think about the sample size. intermediate study. And that's a complicated bit because it's not, there's no simple form of sample size calculations you can do with these literature cries, because the way the weights get updated is not linear in terms of sample size. And I mean, that's where the challenge is. So, I mean, all I'm looking at the moment is just some sort of simple visual sort of presentations of operating characteristics that can help us start sort of honing in on an appropriate design. So what I'm showing here, that you can read, is this is looking at power. So I've got pediatric sample size on the bottom, and then 25 to 50, 75, and then up here I've got bigger jumps, so up to 1,000, just to show what goes on. There's no way you can do a sample size of 1,000 children, but just to see, you know, the operating characteristics. And then the rows is the prior weight on the adult information, going from zero prior weight up to 90% prior weight. So as you would expect with power, the bigger sample size, the more power you've got, the higher the prior weight you put on the adult information, because the adult information is consistent with the efficacy, then the higher power you've got. so you know, there's nothing unexpected there. If you look at the type 1 error, that's where things are a little bit more head-scratchy, if you like. So again, the prior weight is zero on the adult information, that's purely just taking the pediatric data, so your type 1 error should drop to 2.5% on one side, whatever your sample size. Once you start bringing in the adult information, then your type 1 error, it actually goes up the sample size, and then at some point it goes down again for the weight. And that's because of this, the way that the weights are being updated. And when you've got very small sample sizes, your this is the likelihood of sample distribution coming from the data, pediatric data is obviously very diffuse because you haven't got much data. And so that likelihood ratio, that probability of data under the main component and the informative component, actually because the data is so diffuse, it can look more consistent with the main component than the informative component. As you start to have a bigger sample size, the likelihood gets more peaked and actually looks more consistent with the informative component. It's got less sort of diffusion, and then at some point you've got so much data in pediatrics that it doesn't really matter what the adult information is, that the pediatric data is tight enough that it will sort of discount most of the adult information. So it's a little bit of a more complex sort of situation, and I think this makes it more difficult to get good intuition around what's going to happen and what sort of sample size you need. And then I think the third thing, which I think is quite a useful thing to think about when designing studies, is a sort of a minimum detectable effect. It's something that we use quite a lot in standard trial designs. And it's a good indicator, it's something that's useful to look at to ensure you haven't got an overpowered trial, because if you've got too large a sample size, you can achieve statistical significance with an observed effect size that's clinically irrelevant. So you know, you have a very small positive effect, but if you've got a large enough sample size, you'll still hit the significance level, but it may not be clinically meaningful. And I think, particularly in these sort of extrapolation studies, it's, if you've got a small pediatric sample size and you've got a strong prior measurement in the adults, you could end up concluding efficacy in pediatrics when you've actually observed a negative effect in pediatrics, because it's just being dominated by the adult prior information. So that's something that I've certainly get sent from the clinicians and regulators. They still care about what we see in the pediatric study as a sort of standalone bit of evidence. And if that's not at least trending in the right direction, whatever weight or however you come up with your prior, they're not comfortable with using it. So I think it's at least a useful sort of criteria to look at. So here, sort of showing that for a particular again, some pediatric sample size and choice of prior weight, what's the, in this case, it's the maximum, because we're looking for a confidence or below one for a rate ratio scale, so low is good. So what's the maximum observed rate ratio in the pediatric data that once you combine it with the adult information in the mixture prior would give you a significant posterior pregnant effectively? So you can see that as you put a very small sample size with a very high weight at the top, we can observe a rate ratio going in the wrong direction, so above one. So if we get an observed rate ratio above one in pediatrics, but will still conclude efficacy because it's dominated by the adult prior information. Whereas obviously if we put much less prior weight on the adult information, then we need a stronger effect size in the pediatrics in order to conclude that efficacy. So it's quite a useful thing for clinicians to make them understand this. It's like, well, I really need to be seeing, say, at least an 80%, sorry, a rate ratio of 0.8 or less in pediatrics before I'm even going to entertain concluding efficacy. So, yeah, then in terms of trying to sort of come up with a particular design, it's really just a case of almost sort of looking at and overlaying on these grids kind of some key criteria that you're worried that you care about. So you might say, well, let's start by pre-specifying the prior weight. I believe we've got an extrapolation hypothesis, and then use those sort of grids to then identify triplets that are sort of a combination of power type one error and this sort of minimum detection effect that give us an exceptional trade-off. And so this is just, there's no rocket science here. It's obviously, okay, well, 50-50, I believe, in the ability to extrapolate from the adults, so let's sort of mark that on each of these grids. And then we might say, I want to see in my pediatric data at least an effect size of 0.7 or less. So on the effect size, you can mark on that boundary. So basically now it's restricting our design space to anything below blue steps and below the yellow line. So it's that sort of bottom left corner. It's all those combinations of prior weight and sample size satisfy those two criteria. You can then bring in type 1 error. They show the regulators and agree that maximum type 1 error of 10%, so then you draw in the boundary of that. And then overlay all of those to then try and find, maximise your power. So it's actually looking at anything below the intersection of red, blue, and yellow. And then maximise and so you find that smallest sample size to maximise your power is here is n equals 175. And actually that gives you pretty good power, 90% power if you go with the prior weight of 0.3 and a sample size of 175. Now that may still be too big to be feasible, so you then have to sort of push back and sort of But I think what's interesting is that although we sort of started off by saying, okay, well we're willing to go with a prior weight of 0.5, actually the type 1 error trumps that and it sort of pushes down the prior weight if that's what you care about. Another scenario it might not be. So, but I think at least this is a useful way to build up a rationale to sort of at least think and communicate how we might end up with a particular choice of prior weight and sample size that we can work with. So I say, this is still work in progress. Essentially, we haven't taken this approach yet for trials. So I think I haven't really got time, so I do need to catch a train in about 15 minutes.
Well, we've got to spare you any questions.
I don't know how long it's going to be in this station.
Just about. Have you organised a taxi?
Yeah.
A bit to me, it looks a bit sensible to think that whatever you think of the pediatric population should depend on how far away the dangerous is from the actual phase 3 trial.
Sorry, how far away the...
So if your phase 3 trial was on eight to plus,
yes,
and you're trying to extrapolate, obviously you should use that information.
And actually that's one of the things, particularly using this sort of methodology for borrowing on control arms, so not only the setting but adjusting the covariates, or sort of modelling, so modelling the age relationship within the adult study, and then so your priors are just taken as being sort of the summary of all of the data, but you do sort of model-based prediction, you can extrapolate down to the younger age groups. I mean, the way you come up with your informative component of the prior, I think, where I've shown this is the very simplest way of taking the raw data, but you can do a more model-based approach. And I think that's something that you need to sort of look into.
Thank you very much.